This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, why Americans bet on Donald Trump again. In the early hours of Wednesday morning, Donald Trump was declared the winner of the 2024 presidential election. In the hours and days since, we're getting more detailed results. As of Thursday, when we're recording this episode, Trump is on track to sweep all of the swing states. Republicans have taken control of the Senate and are favored to take the House, too. In his victory speech, President-elect Trump referenced his broad coalition, the widest and most diverse Republicans have had in decades.
They came from all corners, union, non-union, African-American, Hispanic-American, Asian-American, Arab-American, Muslim-American. We had everybody, and it was beautiful. It was a historic realignment.
This week, I wanted to talk to someone who could analyze what this outcome says about what people are wanting in this moment, and why, for so many, they're betting on Trump to get us closer to it. George Packer is a staff writer for The Atlantic, an author, and a historian. His work stands out because he has spent lots of time having conversations with Americans of all walks of life all over the country. And he told me that this week's results are consistent with what he's been hearing all year.
I'm not particularly surprised. It seemed like it could go either way, but we know that Donald Trump has a perennial appeal for almost half the country. So there was no way this was going to be an easy win for Kamala Harris, nor was it going to be an easy win for Donald Trump. People are talking as if it was a landslide. It really wasn't. It seems like they're within a point or two in the popular vote, which when I was a kid was an extremely close election. But nowadays, that seems like a comfortable margin. I'm also not surprised because I did enough reporting this year in the Phoenix area and in Western Pennsylvania to know that people were unhappy with the status quo. COVID has cast a really long shadow over this country. I think some families have been able to move on pretty easily, but for a lot of people, there's lasting damage and lasting resentment over the causes of the damage, the lockdowns, the school closings. Inflation has really hurt families on limited incomes, something I heard all the time. And the larger question of whether Trump is fit for office and whether he is a potential authoritarian ruler, which concerns me greatly, just doesn't have a lot of traction for a surprising number of Americans who are maybe more focused on the immediate struggles caused by inflation. So all in all, we are a very evenly divided country. Donald Trump should keep that in mind, although I don't think he will. It will be very easy for him to overreach and to antagonize people who voted for him because they're not necessarily in line with the right-wing agenda of his base. And it will be very easy for the Trump administration to get on the wrong side of a lot of Americans, even though at the moment it seems that he's at the peak of his popularity.
I mean, from all of your conversations and the reporting that you've done, it's interesting you say that the idea of Trump leading as an authoritarian or the backsliding of democracy just doesn't end up being a high concern for a lot of folks you're talking to. Inflation and the economy supersedes that. But is it that that concern is low on the list of priorities, or is that not taken as a real threat?
Well, for his real supporters, they have an answer for everything, including January 6th. You raise January 6th, which for me is the disqualifying piece in this entire story. And the answer I heard from people, for example, in the Phoenix area was he didn't send them to commit violence. It was just a rally. And then some people did some bad things, but that wasn't Trump's fault. Or even more conspiratorial, the police invited them in. It was a trap set by the police and the FBI so that they could then crack down on the great MAGA movement. So there were explanations for it. But among others who weren't necessarily going to excuse January 6th and who were even bothered by it, and I don't want to say I didn't talk to people who found January 6th alarming. It's just the immediate question of whether you're having a hard time paying for groceries, buying a house if you're a young family, and if your kids are struggling in school. because perhaps of the extended closings. It just is more immediate and more pressing and less abstract than whether Donald Trump is going to try to take this country in the direction of Hungary or Russia.
You know, I'm glad that you pointed out that it was, in fact, a pretty close result, despite what is being talked about. But what is notable and worth talking about some more is a notable rightward shift across the country, right? What is it that Americans are signaling that they want?
I think there is an unhappiness with the status quo, with the political establishment, with the media. We're part of this too. And Kamala Harris, whether she intended to or not, ran as the candidate of the status quo. And the Democratic Party has sort of been stuck with the mantle of defending the institutions and defending sort of a sane and positive approach to government rather than a burn it all down approach, because Democrats believe in government as a positive force. Well, now they're stuck with it as an unpopular, deeply unpopular institution. And whereas Trump can say, I'm going to tear it up and start over and fix it. And a lot of people are willing to just roll the dice on that. So I don't see a shift to conservatism. What I see is a shift to hostility toward elites and institutions, toward the world that only yesterday seemed to be moving in the right direction for a lot of people who were enjoying the benefits of free trade and globalization and immigration, and who today seem not to care about the struggles of their fellow Americans. Whether or not that's legitimate, I think that's the vision Trump has painted. I think of him not as a conservative, but as a reactionary, in the sense that he wants to restore a sort of imaginary golden age. But here's the irony. His support, as you know, as you alluded to, has gone up among Latinos. It's almost 50%. And among Black men, it's in the high teens, I believe, among young people, especially young men. So the Democratic Party was mistaken and would be really ill-advised to continue to be mistaken in assuming that racial resentment is the source of Trump's popularity, and that all they have to do is point out the obvious bigotry in his behavior and his words in order to show the American people the light. I just don't think that that works. I don't think it's got enough of a basis in reality, and it's not the way people are thinking. People do not vote according to their group identity. And to think that appealing to group identity is the way you get votes, it's just failed.
You know, it's interesting when I'm hearing you talk about Americans really wanting change and rejecting the status quo, and that's what you're seeing in this election outcome. I mean, it's obvious, but worth saying, Donald Trump is a former president. Yes, we are looking for change. What is it about Trump's first term that you think people are wanting more of?
I talked to many people who remember, and perhaps not entirely accurately, being better off when Trump was president, having more disposable income, being able to buy things that they can't buy now, including a house. So that's a strong piece of information for people to carry into the voting booth with themselves. And Harris had the misfortune of carrying the weight of the Biden administration, which she could never shed and didn't try to shed. She famously said, I wouldn't have done anything differently. So once that's the choice, a former president who you remember presiding over a better economy versus a vice president who wouldn't do anything different from the president whose economy has hurt you, that is a pretty bad choice for Democrats. But I fault Joe Biden for that. If he had announced that he was going to yield to the next generation a year ago, as he suggested he would do in 2020, we'd be having a very different conversation right now. We probably would not be talking about the defeat of Vice President Kamala Harris. I don't think she would have become the nominee. I don't think she would have emerged. Instead, she was installed. And that, too, I think, rubbed some voters the wrong way, even though there was that initial euphoria. But that euphoria was bound to be short-lived. It was based on a relief that Biden had stepped aside. But it was, by then, I think, too late. And it became inevitable that his successor, Kamala Harris, would have to carry all the baggage that Biden was carrying, except for his old age. And instead of having the opportunity to choose among the really talented younger Democrats who would have thrown their hat in the ring if there'd been a real competition.
How much, I've been thinking about this question a lot in the past few days. How much is this election outcome about the economy? And how much is it actually about sort of culture war issues?
That's been the question for 8 years, hasn't it?
That
was the question people were asking after 2016. I think they are intimately linked in the following way. If you are economically struggling, if you're pressed, you are likelier to fall to the appeal of your resentments of immigrants, of the border crossings, of trans issues and the idea that children are being taken away from their parents' control, the idea that schools are being used to indoctrinate children. All of that is going to, you're going to be more vulnerable to that if you feel already aggrieved economically, and you're going to feel that other people, undeserving people, have cut in front of you. In spite of all your hard work, you cannot get ahead because people are being brought into the country and put in line in front of you. And so you can't really separate the two. I think the fact that the economy was considered a negative issue by so many people meant that a lot of people who might share the more progressive views of the Democrats on cultural issues still voted for Trump out of sheer pocketbook anxiety. Mm-hmm. I think you can't underestimate that. That doesn't make it a very ideologically interesting election. It makes it an election about inflation, which is pretty simple, not interesting, maybe inaccurate since the rate has come down and unemployment is at historic lows and interest rates are falling and the American economy has done better than any other major economy coming out of COVID. Nonetheless, all that matters is whether, you know, at the end of the month, you feel you have less money than you did 4 years ago.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what it is, right? I mean, you just ran through the list of sort of economic markers that are true and that are factual and that we've heard discussed in the media now plenty of times leading up to this election by way of sort of fact checking at times what Trump is saying at his rallies. And yet, like you said, it just doesn't connect to how people are feeling and how people are actually sitting there with their budgets at home and trying to figure out how to make ends meet. So what happens when there is a disconnect between what is true and real and what is also truly being felt by people and truly being experienced by people?
Yeah, I think the worst thing a politician can do is to tell people, actually, what you're feeling isn't based in reality. So change your feelings. People don't change their feelings. And although Kamala Harris never said that, she never said, we made some mistakes. And all of that, I think, suggested that she could sit with the status quo and the country would reject Trump. But instead, the status quo was what the country was rejecting. And so she needed to be willing to take lots of risks, which she wasn't.
I mean, it's obvious and understandable that people want their groceries to be affordable. They want their lives to be affordable. But when you look at the objective facts, so many of the things that voters say that they want in this economy, Trump's policies would simply not deliver.
Right.
I mean, his tax policy would cut taxes for top earners, raise taxes on others. We know from his first term that he passed deep tax cuts for the ultra wealthy and for big corporations. Many economists say that his proposals he's talking about for his next term would raise the cost of goods for people. So help me understand this disconnect that's happening here between what voters say that they want and what Trump himself says he will do.
First of all, for a lot of voters, it doesn't matter what he says or really what she says. There is a deep, you could almost say, tribal identification with one party or the other. Now, there's plenty of people who could jump and have jumped. And I think Kamala Harris's strategy was try to peel them off. Republican women in the Philadelphia suburbs, things like that. But as for whether people are paying attention to Trump's tariff promises or his tax cut history or what, you know, Nobel Prize winning economists are warning about, I just don't think either policy or expert judgment has much effect anymore. It used to, but it doesn't have much effect anymore. And that's why when Democrats come out with a policy agenda, although I think it's really important, it rarely moves the needle. And then you hear people saying, I just want more specifics, which is sort of maddening, because would more specifics really push your vote? I think what a lot of people are saying when they ask for specifics is, I don't believe you. I don't think it's going to make any difference in my life. So you can't really give me enough policy to win my vote.
It's almost saying I'm already unconvincible in a way.
Right. I'm just so deeply skeptical. And let's not underestimate the cynicism about politics in general and politicians and both parties among people in places like Charleroi, Pennsylvania, who have seen their town and their factories and their lives in a state of decline for decades now, and have probably heard the promises, because it's a major stop in presidential elections every 4 years, they've heard the promises going back to the 80s, the 90s, the aughts, and nothing has ever made a difference. So why wouldn't they end up saying, I don't believe them, and I a plague on them both?
Tell me a little bit more about Charleroi, because you spent some time there and talking to people. Unpack for me a little bit about the dynamics that you discovered there.
It's a declining industrial town on the Monongahela River south of Pittsburgh. Very small town. It has glassmaking. In fact, it's where Pyrex is made. But in September, two things happened almost simultaneously that at least brought it to my attention. One was the Pyrex factory owners announced they were going to close the factory by the end of the year and move the operations to Ohio with about half the workforce that was willing to move. So in other words, hundreds of union jobs, well-paying union jobs, were going to disappear from Charleroi, which couldn't afford to lose them. And almost at the same time, Trump heard about Charleroi, I think from a local politician, and heard that it had actually received 2,000 immigrants in just the last few years, which is a 50% increase in the very declining small population that was there, which was almost entirely white, and the immigrants were almost entirely Black. They were from Haiti. They were from West Africa. So a sudden demographic change. And without knowing or caring about Charleroi, Trump started putting it in his speeches. It became the next Springfield, Ohio, minus the cats and dogs, saying that that the immigrants were ruining it, crime, gangs, bankruptcy, you name it. None of it true. Mm. In fact, people I talked to said the immigrants were legal. They're in this country legally. They had jobs. They had contributed to the town's tax base. They were occupying empty houses. There were people on the street again after the place had kind of become a ghost town. Yes, there were also strains on resources, on schools. But clearly, on the whole, immigration has been a good thing for Charleroi. But Trump put his finger in that wound and heedlessly stirred up people's anxieties, their anger, and then moved on. And Charleroi was left sort of traumatized. I was told immigrants stopped going outside as much, thought about moving, pulling their kids out of school. So just when the town was coming back from the dead, these borough council president said to me, it seemed like it was slipping back into the bad old days. But it's also Trump country. The voters are overwhelmingly Republican, which is interesting because a generation or two ago, they were overwhelmingly Democratic. It was a union town. It was a working class town. And of course, many of them felt the Democratic Party was no longer their party. The Democratic Party had become the party of people in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh and in California. And the Republican Party seemed to be the party of people in Charleroi. Except, what has the Republican Party done for Charleroi? What has private equity and Wall Street and billionaires and Elon Musk done for Charleroi? Nothing. In fact, in some ways, made it worse by stripping the assets and taking the jobs away. So neither party could tell the people of Charleroi, we have helped you and will continue to help you. Neither party could claim to care honestly about what's happened in Charleroi. The Democrats have lost that base. They've lost that connection to working people. The Republicans are still the party of the high earners who are going to benefit from Trump's tax cuts. But given that choice between two parties that really don't seem to have a plan or even a desire to help, people are more likely to choose the party that appeals to the resentments, the anger, the alienation. And that's Trump's party.
Mm. Not to mention, I mean, something that I've heard a lot in the past few days is people who voted for Trump, people who identify as Republicans, saying, you know, why would I vote for Democrats? Why would I vote for a party that calls me racist, that calls me uninformed, that really discounts me as an American and as a voter? That seems like a very valid part of the resentment toward the Democratic Party.
Going back to Hillary Clinton's deplorables, Joe Biden's garbage, which I honestly don't think he was talking about Trump supporters writ large. I think he was talking about the kind of people who were invited to speak at Trump's rallies. But it was a huge mistake. Yeah, there is some legitimate resentment of condescension, of moral superiority. It's a tricky one, Shamita, because there is racism, there is sexism, there is resistance to a Black woman candidate, especially emphasis on the woman part. So it's not as though we can say it doesn't exist and it's a complete mistake and wrong to do to Trump voters, but it really doesn't get you anywhere with them. Mm. And it's probably only one part of many factors that include all the other things we've been talking about. And to highlight it as the only cause, which is what progressives have done ever since 2016, was a costly mistake. Hmm. As I said, I think the most thoughtful progressives are moving away from that, partly because the election results just disprove it. The demographic change in Trump's support just says stop thinking of politics entirely in terms of race. It just doesn't work. Mm. But that doesn't mean there isn't some truth to it. It's just not a truth that helps the Democrats to highlight.
You know, you write in that piece on Charleroi that political behavior in the Trump era is determined by how class and race interact. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why you think it's crucial to talk about these things together and not isolate them?
And I really should have added gender. Because the Black and Latino voters who are drifting toward the Republican Party tend to be non-college educated voters and tend to be men. So when you have a combination of non-college educated, white and non-white men, that's really become Trump's base. And when you have a pool of voters who are college educated, white and non-white women, that's the most reliable Democratic voter. But honestly, if you're running for president, you cannot afford to see your potential supporters in those buckets because you're just going to lose too many people. You're going to fail to appeal to them. You're going to make assumptions about them that might not be true. And there is no way to assume, as I said earlier, that identity will determine political preference. And once you do, even almost subconsciously, you're headed for defeat.
You know, I'm thinking about what Bernie Sanders has said by way of criticism of Democrats. He wrote, "It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them." What is he saying that the Democratic Party is getting so wrong here? Is he saying that they're getting it wrong on policy? Is he saying they're getting it wrong on messaging? Is he saying both?
You know, you could look at the history of Democratic policy on workers and say, what's the problem? They are far more likely to support unions. They're far more likely to support paid sick leave, childcare, tax increases on the rich and on corporations, etc. Yes, all that's true, but they've also been in the lead on free trade, been in the lead on mass immigration, which is a mixed bag, but I think there's a serious case to be made that it has hurt people at the lower end of the economic scale by driving down wages and competition for jobs. So the policies may sound better, but the effects are terrible. And Even Sherrod Brown in Ohio, who has devoted his entire career to being a voice for working people in Ohio and in America, lost on Tuesday because the Democratic Party has just lost that identification with working people. And it's partly cultural, it's partly economic, and it's partly just, are they there? Is the party structure present in working class communities? How vibrant is the local Democratic Party? Who do voters see as the representatives of the Democratic Party? They basically see Ivy League graduates, celebrities, and, you know, the Obamas and the Clintons. And it's very hard to create that sense of, I understand you, I'm actually one of you, that people today seem to need because their cynicism about politicians is so deep.
So these are some examples, I suppose, of sort of bad messengers or people that might be perceived as bad carriers of the message. Who's seen as a reliable, trustworthy carrier of the message to this group of voters that voted for Donald Trump that wants change?
Well, when I was out in Western Pennsylvania, I spent part of a day with a congressman named Chris DeLuzio, who is a one-term Democrat, represents, I think, Pennsylvania's 17th district, which is a mixed district of red and blue, but it's definitely a working class district. And it includes one county, Beaver County, that is solidly red. And Chris DeLuzio's approach is to be very present for constituents, to spend a lot of time with them, and to push issues in which the ordinary voter is pitted against large forces like corporations. For example, there was that freight train derailment just across the state line in East Palestine, Ohio, last year that sent a toxic cloud across into his district. Mm-hmm. And he has spent the last year and a half pushing a bill to more strictly regulate rail freight, a bill that his opponent, I don't know if he ever took a position, but he certainly didn't make it his own. That kind of thing, maybe not that issue in itself, but that kind of thing has traction. It seems to meet people where they are. And he won re-election pretty comfortably the other night in a bad year for Democrats and bad year for Democrats in Pennsylvania. So that might tell you that there's some way for Democrats to reestablish that connection of trust with working people that they've lost over the decades. This is a long process. It's been going on for 40 or 50 years, but Tuesday was maybe the rock bottom of it.
Let's talk briefly, if we can, just about the media in general. I mean, in some ways, it feels like we're having some of the same conversations that happened post-2016, you know, asking ourselves what role did the media play in deepening this political divide and at alienating this huge part of the electorate. How do you see this as similar in this moment, dissimilar?
Feels the same, only more. Yeah. It feels like things have accelerated. The trends of 2016 have accelerated. And what do I mean by that? Well, the economic basis for journalism, and by journalism, I really mean the kind of work that takes time, that requires travel and therefore money, reporting, it used to be called, that has been harder and harder to do financially and maybe less and less appealing because it's not the way journalists seem to make a name for themselves anymore. Of course, there's great reporting, but when we think of the media today, we think of hot takes, we think of social media posts, we think of a group of attractive people in a cable news studio talking on and on about what the American people think, when actually they have no idea because they're in a cable news studio. We see news outlets collapsing right and left and local news almost vanishing, which is part of the problem, because now instead of having a local newspaper to tell you what just happened with this rail disaster a few miles from your house, you have to go to social media where there's a lot of lies and conspiracies, or to national news, which probably doesn't care very much about your train derailment, but is more interested in the latest little mini scandal on the campaign trail. So our job should be to understand and to inform. And it's also really hard given the information world people live in, where a fact just instantly vanishes upon contact with your mind because, first of all, there's too many of them. And second, too many of them are not facts, and too many people are yelling at you at once. And you then will go to one source because it makes you feel a little better than another source, but that might not even be informing you very well. I mean, we're just all under this tremendous pressure all the time to find our own way through this blizzard of information that is, our brains are not capable of absorbing and sorting through. That doesn't mean we're stupid. It means we're just not made that way. Our technology is far, far out ahead of our long evolved, wonderful human brains.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time talking about what the millions of people who did vote for Trump want and what they expect from a president. Before I let you go, just millions of people voted for Kamala Harris. What do they want? What do they expect? Mm. And what do we do now in a country where the electorate is nearly split in half?
I think a lot of them just wanted a decent person in the White House, which didn't seem like a very high request, but they were disappointed. But I think the people who were disappointed on Tuesday night should resist the temptation to feel as if the rest of the American people are benighted and hopelessly sunk into some kind of cult of personality that has all the wrong values. They may feel that way, but to act on it is to guarantee that you're going to continue to be disappointed on election night. And instead, organize and push issues that really matter to large numbers of people and that are not the pet obsessions of a small class of donors and activists who have kind of had the Democratic Party in their grip for a while. And rebuild the party from the bottom up and not the top down. Go into the communities where the party has hollowed out and rebuild it. And don't wait for the next Barack Obama to come riding in to save it. And just do the hard work of politics, which means persuading and listening and organizing.
Thank you. Really, I really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks for your time.
Me too. Thanks for having me on.
You can read George Packer's reporting for The Atlantic on Apple News. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.